Morning, everybody. We are going to start our session with a discussion on income taxes. Peter.
Thanks. Just a couple of introductory words. The purpose of this session really is to give you the background you need for the agenda discussion we're having tomorrow. So with that, I'll pass over to Mitsuhiro and Grace. Good evening, everybody.
Good morning to you. Thank you very much, Peter, for introduction. Okay, let me start from today's plan. We have about 90 minutes time slot just for income tax education session. 90 minutes is quite long. I don't want board members to get bored of staff explanation, so we would like to divide it into a number of small sessions. And at the end of each small session, we would like to ask board members comments. The first session, I would like to confirm the objective of income tax research project and explain the history of board projects on income tax. And then next, I will provide high-level summary of staff findings from research activities so far, including main reason for today's problem in income tax accounting, as well as five possible ways for us to address those issues. I plan to spend about 10 to 15 minutes for those topics. Then, in next session, I will ask Grace to explain briefly a type 1 issue which possibly require a fundamental change in principle in IS 12, and ask board members comment on those type 1 issue. What type 1 issue, I will explain later. Then, in next session, I will explain two examples of type 2 issue, which are likely to be addressed by narrow scope amendments. And then finally, Grace is going to explain type 3 issue, which is more focusing on investor outreach and tax disclosure improvements. We plan to allocate about 20 minutes for discussion in each type of issues. So we have three types, so 3 multiply 20 is 60 minutes, and we have about 10-15 minutes introduction, so we are probably spending up 90 minutes time slot. Is board member having any question or comments or suggestion of change in staff plan on how we run the meeting? Otherwise, I would like to continue. Okay. Thank you. So let me start from objective of income tax research project. The objective of income tax research project is to better understand the needs of financial statement stakeholders on income tax accounting and stimulate discussion on income tax before 2015 agenda consultation on whether the standards should undergo fundamental change or continue to focus on narrow scope amendments. Okay, history. The first IS 12 was issued by the ISC, the board predecessor, in 1979, based on timing difference approach, which is also known as income approach or income statement approach. Then in 1996, the ISC board changed the accounting model from timing difference approach to temporal difference approach, which is also known as the balance sheet liability approach. The 1996 version of IS 12 was adopted by the ISB in 2001 and still exists today as a part of the IFRS standards. From 2003 to 2010, income tax was selected as one of those convergence projects with the US FASB, and both boards worked on the convergence on income tax accounting. However, in 2009, FASB decided to suspend the tax project. The ISB alone published exposure draft in 2009, but it did not finalize the exposure draft at the new IFRS because it did not get much support from respondents of ED. Instead, the ISB board decided to address some practice issue by narrow scope amendments. As a consequence, in 2010, ISB issued the amendment deferred tax recovery of underlying asset that has provided practical solution to the deferred tax accounting for investment property measured at fair value. Since then, The interpretation committee has been dealing with many income tax questions. Income tax topics was actually one of the top three topics in interpretation committee's work from 2012 to 2014. The interpretation committee addressed those problems by conducting narrow scope amendments or publishing draft interpretation, which is currently under deliberation, or providing technical explanation in reaction note. There was also a case in which interpretation committee rejected but also recommended the board to assess and analyze the issue in the board project on research project on income tax. An example of such issue is a corporate wrapper, which the staff will explain later in today's meeting. So this is a history. I would like to continue to explain the finding from research activities, but if board members have any questions about history and objective, please ask us, otherwise I will continue.
No questions?
Okay, let me continue to explain the staff finding of research activities so far. Based on the research activity that staff have conducted so far, we have identified three major reasons for today's problems in application by 12. The first category, first type one issues, is the issue that involves accounting mismatch between tax expense and related income, and some people are not convinced of accounting results that IS-12 create. Those issues include the issue of intercompany transfer of asset and the issue of tax base in local currency other than functional currency. Staff thinks that addressing those type 1 issues will likely require a fundamental change in principle in IS-12. So Grace is going to explain type 1 issues later in today's meeting. Second reason in today's problem in accounting for income tax is that it does not fit well with more recent IFRS standards or more recent tax laws around the world. Those issues include the issue of corporate wrapper and the issue of tax effect of dividend. Staff think that those issues can be addressed by narrow scope amendments. Board doesn't need to provide and conduct fundamental change to address those issues. So I will explain more detail about those issues after Grace's explanation about type 1 issue. Then the third reason is that tax is very complex and tax disclosure is very difficult to understand. That's why people think it's a problem. We have conducted some investor outreach, and users are interested in tax disclosures rather than the issues in first two categories, and they continue to say they want improvement in tax disclosures. So Grace is going to explain about users' needs later in today's meeting. To deal with those practice issues, staff think that there are five possible ways for us. I have already mentioned three. That is, the first option is the fundamental change in standards and in principle. This is effective, especially in dealing with type 1 issue, but will require a lot of time and resources. Many respondents to the agenda consultation didn't support this option. And second option is to continue dealing with practice issue by narrow scope amendments. That option was supported by some respondents to the agenda consultation, but based on staff observation, there was no predominant view on which issue is more important than the other. Third option is to focus on tax disclosure and improve disclosure to be more useful for investors' needs. That is what many users of financial statements said to us in our investor outreach. The fourth option is to provide educational material to help consistent application of IS-12. And fifth option is do nothing or just continue. That's the intervention committee to deal with all tax questions. So those are the summary of staff finding in research activities so far. Grace is going to explain about type 1 issue, but before doing so, I would like to invite any comment or question from board members.
Darrell? Just a very quick question.
And this may be specific to a jurisdiction, or to one jurisdiction that I'm talking to anyway, where they have various different taxes, and the taxes are questionable about whether they fit into either the income tax definition or don't fit into the income tax definition. I just wondered, in your findings, the issue that I've specifically heard then is the concern around what I call the cliff effect, that if something is in IS-12, it's treated one way. If it falls outside of IS-12, the treatment is very different. That doesn't seem to get picked up in your Type 1, Type 2, or Type 3, although I think it fits somewhere between Type 1 and Type 2. It's either a fundamental difference because of the, or it's a difference because of the IFRSs we've issued subsequent to IS-12. I think later in the document you talk about it coming up in terms of a definition. I was just wondering if from your user outreach or from the outreach, you heard any other jurisdictions that found that cliff effect was a big concern.
Yes, can I answer? Yes, based on our user outreach, we didn't hear much issues about scope of income tax from users. The scoping issue we hear mainly from preparers and accounting firms. And we think we in the agenda paper 19A, I think we put that issue in type 2 issue. IS-12 was developed based on typical tax system around the world, but after publishing IS-12, we were told that there are more variety of tax system around the world. But because it raised to more fundamental scoping issue of standard, we think that it fit well with fundamental review of standard rather than narrow scope amendments.
Mary?
Ms. Hiro, on agenda paper 19A, page 17, where you summarize type 1, type 2, type 3, based on the cause of the issues, I'm about to ask you whether the following characterization is correct, that users, the concerns raised by users are mostly type 3, and the concerns raised by preparers are mostly type 1 and type 2, or rather, sorry, let me, concerns raised by users are mostly type 3. The type 1 and type 2 were raised mostly by preparers. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, that's correct. And if I could add, accounting firms also ask questions about type 1, type 2, rather than type 3.
And one of the reasons I'm asking is, I think there's a presumption, which isn't bad, but maybe we should challenge from time to time, that if people are raising problems, we should try to answer them, as opposed to, is it people not liking the outcome, even if others find the information useful or relevant. So when I look at type 1, type 2, type 3, I'm not sure all of these are actually problems with IS-12, but they are actually all concerns that different stakeholders have raised. So I think we just have to think about why they're on the list. And that's, I think you've done that a lot in the research, but maybe just remembering that we should go back and kind of think about that aspect also.
Yes, I think Mary, you are absolutely right. Not all issues are problem in IS-12. But just some people have concerns in result of from applying IS-12, especially type 1 issue is not really a problem in IS-12, but just people don't like answer from IS-12 and may want different accounting model to be used. Type 2 issue may be some inconsistency, so maybe a problem. Type 2 issue is more usefulness of information from user viewpoint, so there are difference in those types.
Okay. Sue? I agree with Mary's general observation, and that would have been my suspicion as well. My only hesitation, though, is given the complexity of tax accounting and also how difficult it can be to understand the information that ends up in the financial statements, I wonder whether there might be situations where users aren't aware of the issues that are in type 1 and type 2 because it's sort of impenetrable.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Stephen?
I was going to say the same thing. I think type 3, it's clear that investors have a more pervasive problem of understanding and a lack of tax disclosure. Type 1 and type 2, I don't think that it's commonly raised by investors, either because the impact is not so big that it really has a major impact on their analysis, or because they don't really understand and just can't see the effect. I mean, my experience that when this does become really big, then investors do pay attention. So this intercompany transfer of assets is an issue, I think, in the pharma industry, and I remember the pharma analysts knowing about this, and kind of it's in the back of their mind. So I think if you were to do more detailed outreach with investors pointing out some of these particular issues, then you might get quite a different response.
But on that farm type 1, you know, so 32A little 1, you said the pharma industry analysts aware of that. Do they think it gives them insights into the tax, or they think it's an anomaly that they're trying to adjust for? Okay.
John Wu.
Thank you. Let's go to the some. May I go to the example 2 here?
Yes.
Example 2.
Example for the type A. So, Grace is going to explain example 2 in the next session. So.
Because we are talking about types and A, B, and C.
But if your question relates to more
problems or not. So if we go to the one specific example, then it might be easy to understand that this type A, B, and C are real examples or not.
Yeah.
Problems or not.
If that's the case, you could go to example 2.
Yes.
Hi, Mitsuhiro. First, a general comment on this. First of all, thank you for the excellent set of papers. And not surprising to me, since I know you've been involved with this for a long time, and I do remember, and I agree with assessments made formally by Mary, Sue, and Steve, and in my life in the board, 7 years now, the type 1 issue is the most pervasive in Latin America, and actually, there are a number of users in that region that do care quite a lot about type 1 issues, and why? Because it's not uncommon to have large companies, exporters, having a functional currency that is not the currency where they are based. So the effects are significant. Almost since I've been here, companies have constantly raised this issue. I think the Mexicans, soon after they adopted IFRS recently, they brought it to the interpretation committee, try to. It's not that the application of IS 12 is wrong. It's actually aligned with what Mitsuhiro said. They don't like the answer provided by IS 12. And why they don't like? Because preparers think it's counterintuitive, and also users and their investors agree with them. So almost all companies that I discussed it with in Brazil, Mexico, most of them, they do have in their presentations and discussion with users this aspect very clearly explained in order to provide more color around the effects of IS 12 and interaction, of course, with IS 21. Yeah, so type 1 to me is one of the most pervasive, counterintuitive aspects of IS 12.
But perhaps I could sort of ask in a way, Mitsuhiro, a similar question to what Mary asked, because my perception is that users generally have very little understanding of what the deferred tax information can tell them. It sounds complicated, and they don't really understand it. So my perception is they tend to ignore it totally, and so they probably don't get into type 1 and type 2 issues because they have just totally ignored it. And I think that's quite a big problem, that we're producing information that may or may not be useful to them, but they're not even considering it because they find it too difficult to understand.
Mm.
Thank you. It's seems to me we should evaluate whether these are real problems or not, or big significant problems or not. However, I feel like these might be some problem, because based on your good examples and the general discussion, some of our requirements in IAES 12 are different from US GAAPs. That's the one possibility why some problems are posed by this kind of things. Another thing is, as you said, you know, some accounting firms and the preparers are suggesting there is some kind of problem. And based on your analysis, the IAS 12 are producing some kind of counterintuitive results based on their intercompany, you know, transfer of assets, you know, buyers the tax rate and seller tax rate. If we use if they're the same, then no problem. But as Amaro just suggested, if different countries you are operating in, then maybe these kind of things might happen. So based on this kind of things, you know, these issues might be some important issues to deal with. That's what I'm saying. Rather than talking about the general ideas, maybe we'll go back to the examples that, you know, you can be demonstrate that these problems are more easily. You know, that's what I'm saying. Okay.
Thank you. Pat? I just had a broad question, I guess, and this is to either Peter or Mitsuhiro. In looking at the options that you've laid out here, one of the options that you didn't identify is, as I recall, a favorite of the former chairman here, David Tweedy, which is the flow-through method of accounting for income taxes. And the question, I guess, is whether or not the current version of IAS 12 and or any of the changes that you're proposing, would you say is better or less aligned with our conceptual framework, either the existing or the proposed? In other words, what is it about deferred tax assets or deferred tax liabilities that you believe meet the definition of an asset or liability under the conceptual framework, proposed one or the existing one? And are in fact any of these approaches going to improve the understandability of information that is in financial statements? Peter made the observation, which I think is spot on based on my experience, that analysts don't really look at the tax note unless they hear that industry has a particular problem and they go looking to see what disclosures that might be there. Otherwise, when I looked at their models over the years, they basically applied a flow-through method approach in their model, which was ignoring deferred tax consequences, right? Just applying a tax rate to what they think is the reported cash income of an entity. So I guess the question is twofold, really. Is what we're doing here going to be consistent with our proposed changes to the existing and the proposed changes of the conceptual framework? And secondly, Why not go to a much simpler approach? Why not consider the flow-through method at this point in time if in fact we take a holistic reevaluation of this whole area? Either one of you guys want to respond?
Well, first of all, Pat, you mentioned about changing from balance sheet approach to flow-through approach. Right. That is actually Option one to change the fundamental model from balance sheet approach to something else. And something else could be a flow-through approach.
Okay.
So we'll need to evaluate which approach best suit with investors' needs and best suit with the conceptual framework. We looked at previous document issued by other standard setter when they adopted balance sheet approach. And those documents explain how they justify deferred tax asset and liability meet definition of asset and liability under framework. So depending on how you explain, it is possible to say deferred tax asset and liability meet definition of asset and liability under framework. But as you know, of course, there's a counter argument say deferred tax asset and liability doesn't meet definition of asset and liability. So this is still a question in our society.
Well, I think that's a key question here as we go forward, because if in fact the plan is just to do narrow scope amendments, then effectively I think you're accepting that in fact deferred taxes and liabilities do fit kind of squarely, or at least pretty well, within the existing and proposed conceptual framework. And to me, that's a question that probably is worth re-examining. If in fact this whole area is giving rise to an amount of complexity that may be, you know, more than it's worth.
Maybe I can add some comments. So first of all, if we do a fundamental re-examination, that's not a quick project. On flow-through, my perspective is flow-through is just giving up totally on accrual accounting, which I personally find quite unpalatable. I think there are some things that we call deferred tax assets and liabilities that, to my mind, clearly meet the definition of assets and liabilities. So an example is where you've got some of what we've called in the paper book before tax differences. For example, if you've accrued interest income, but you're only being taxed on a cash basis, I think that's clearly a liability there. I think there are others, and that applies more perhaps to some of the so-called tax before book differences, where you might argue that they're more like a valuation adjustment to the underlying item rather than a separate asset or liability. Whether you'd want to go to the trouble of separating those out is another kind of practical issue. But I think there are some cases where they clearly meet the definition. And I think there are some cases where deciding not to recognize them would risk giving quite misleading information, really.
Do you think that the proposed definition that we outlined for a liability in the framework, along the lines of practically unavoidable context, is more consistent with accounting for deferred tax liabilities?
I don't think it makes a difference. I think it's the same either way, to be honest.
I'm not so sure of that, because if in fact your simple example of accrued interest, okay, if in fact you argue, you know, the IFRIC 21 approach, which is I don't have a liability until I actually collect that interest, as opposed to it's practically unavoidable that I'm going to have a tax liability, you get two different outcomes. And I think, you know, a real narrow interpretation could argue I don't have a deferred tax liability, depending on how you go on that definition.
May I just ask you to Pat, why do those investors ignore the deferred tax expense? Because they are
It requires too much knowledge of tax law in a given jurisdiction. So if you look at a multinational, for example, and it's taxed in the UK, let's say the Netherlands and Singapore, as well as Japan, understanding the book tax differences is really, you know, it's unwieldy, right? So they just tend to ignore it and wait for the tax consequences to actually hit, you know, the cash flow statement. Unless, you know, if there's an industry where you know that there's a particular kind of tax issue looming out there on the horizon that they need to be aware of. But it's just, for somebody who comes into an industry new, unless they really pour through the financial statements and really get to know what the major risk factors are for that sector, they tend to just overlook it.
I think it's part of the communication problem as well, because I think the fact that we call it deferred tax, it sounds very unclear and confusing. At the time we did IS 12, I think the Canadian board actually had a good idea, which we didn't follow, that in their standard, which they issued at the same time, they decided to call it future tax rather than deferred tax, because it is focusing on future tax consequences of things that have already occurred. And I actually think that would have been a much clearer label, and I wish we'd done it at the same time.
Can I add one comment? Peter and Pat said investor ignore deferred tax. This may be right, but not completely consistent with what we heard from investors. Investors are using some part of deferred tax information. For example, when an investor needs to estimate future cash flow, including cash tax outflow, and when investors estimate future tax cash outflow, they basically estimate pre-tax cash flow multiplying by the effective tax rate. But if company have tax loss carry forward, they consider tax loss carry forward. Because if company have a huge amount of tax loss carry forward, company wouldn't pay any income tax in 5 years or 10 years. So deferred tax information regarding tax loss carry forward is useful information for investors. But as I said, as Peter and Pat said, I agree that investors are not using deferred tax information on the entirety. They're just picking up useful information from balance sheet, income statement, or footnote to the financial statement.
We go.
My question, Peter, you know, it relates what you just said, or Masihiro also confirmed, that is, investors ignore the tax-related information. Then the question is, for us, you know, one of the proposals is to improve disclosure. The question is whether it is possible to do so. And let me first recall two factors. Firstly, about 16 years ago, one of my PhD students, his dissertation is about income tax. Originally, his idea is to do empirical research, but failed to do so. The reason is, you know, even though we have looks like we have clear principles of our current accounting standards, but actually what you can see from published financial statements is a mixed things, consequence of different jurisdictions, tax regulations, or different asset liabilities, revenue, and others. And so it is hard to find, you know, clear, you know, link this effect to a particular transaction or particular business. This, and then later on he transferred his the topic into another one. And the second factor was, you know, when we developed the previous financial statement presentation project, the key idea is to have a business investing and operating, financing and investing sections, and follow the coherence the ideas. But also another important thing is to have so-called disaggregations, and to disaggregate as detailed as possible the transactions or asset liabilities, and link all the flows stuck together. And from the ideally, if tax effect can also link to those sectors or disaggregated small part, it will be ideal. Then the investors can see clearly. But yes, it is impossible. And then we create a separate sections in the final income statement called income tax. Also, the cash flow statement and the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So back to the question I want to ask the people. You know, you said ignore because, you know, the investors may not know, as you know, Pat mentioned, or it's nearly impossible to find the clues. Therefore, there is impossible to improve disclosure.
I
would like to add one comment, is that one of the reasons why investors are ignoring the deferred tax disclosures is because they have explained that the current disclosure is very overly aggregated. Just an example is in the tax reconciliation, the reconciliation of tax expense or tax rate, or the tax incentives or the tax arrangements in different jurisdictions are all summed up into one line, and is called the foreign tax differential, and that it provides almost no information for investors. So what they are asking for is not a company to disclose every tax payment in every jurisdiction, but only the major drivers for a specifically higher or lower tax rate for the company. So I think that is what Wei Guo has commented, that one of the way to improve is to disaggregate the current disclosure.
FASB actually proposed or decided, I forget which one it is, but to disaggregate between foreign tax and domestic tax. So that is one of the ways that that may meet, not completely, but partially, the investors' need.
Yeah, and I think if we were going to try and improve the disclosures, some of it might be through better enforcement or better application of existing requirements. Some of it might be looking at to see whether we need to change the requirements. I don't think we have a sense yet of sort of what that balance would be if we did want to do something.
Can I ask further questions? You know, recently you can see the newspaper, particularly UK, published a lot of cases like the tax issue, Apple's or Starbucks and Google and others. My question is to some extent related to whether it is possible, because the methodology we use is to use particular rate, try to come out the accrued basis, accrued tax expenses or others.
Yeah.
And but you know, if you look at the countries, the enforcement for major the taxpayers, major companies, quite often the case, you know, there may be some kind of negotiation between the company and the tax regulators, and the final result of the tax payment is actually may not be purely based on the particular rate.
Sure.
And then I'm not sure whether, you know, this is another problem, so whether it is possible for us to provide clear guidance on how to disclose. Maybe, you know, Gary,
wait.
Please.
Wait, sorry. The FASB has recently issued an exposure draft on the disclosure of government assistance, including tax incentive. And in that proposal, they are asking companies to disclose specific arrangements with local governments. So I think that is the disclosures that is related to what you have just said now.
Yeah, that is one of the examples that how we could provide useful information to investors. Another example is, for example, investor basically estimate pre-tax cash flow and multiply effective tax rate and want to know whether the effective tax rate is sustainable or subject to some risk. So maybe improving disclosure on tax uncertainties, including what you mentioned, the negotiation between information about, you know, how negotiation between company and tax authorities are doing, is going to be well or bad, maybe useful information for investors. And other example is, as Grace mentioned, maybe providing additional information about what arrangement entity has agreed with tax authority in particular jurisdiction. And one other thing that we heard from investors is that investors want to know total picture of tax loss carry forward. At this moment, IAS 12 required to recognize deferred tax asset for tax loss carry forward only for the portion that will be realized in the future, but investors want to know the entire picture. So one other possibility is to introduce the two-step approach that US GAAP have, you know, providing deferred tax asset in full and then reducing it by valuation allowance. So we have a several idea on how we could improve presentation disclosure to be more useful for investors.
Maybe a couple of other comments on those points. First of all, when people raise some of these specific disclosure issues, my first reaction is often, in theory, this ought to show up in the tax reconciliation. So it may be partly a question of are the tax reconciliations disaggregated enough in practice. The second thing is, I mean, I haven't been to all of the outreach meetings, but I went to some of them. And what I heard was investors are very interested in knowing about future changes in tax rates. But our disclosures are really focused on what's been recognised. And so if it's a future rate that's beyond something that affects what's already recognised, either current or deferred, then our disclosures won't pick that up. But the investors, of course, aren't really as interested in that distinction. They're more interested in forecasting the whole future stream. So that might be an area where we might want to consider adding something if we were going to try and add to the information that investors get.
Martin.
Based on my experience, I think investors are really interested in the tax, because many companies, it is more than 40% of really net income, so I cannot understand if they are not interested, because it's 40% of net income. And what I have seen, they are really not interested in the details, how calculated deferred tax is, but they're looking at what is the effective tax rate of a company, compare that with others, and if there is different from others, they really want to understand why. And if you then don't, for example, what people now saying, calculate on a cash basis, don't have deferred taxes, I think it is impossible really to make a meaningful number of that, because when I'm coming from a jurisdiction where, and only from an industry which was more fair value, but the tax regime was on really on a cash basis, on a realized cash basis, and if you would not have really deferred taxes, I think the results are meaningless, absolutely meaningless. And therefore, my to think about going to a different world, I don't really can imagine that makes sense at all. But I think really what people want to understand is really investors don't want to give any nitty-gritty of deferred taxes, but if there is the effective tax rate is different, they want to understand why. And maybe we can address that with better disclosure, but I don't think we should really thinking about changing the whole deferred tax world, because for certain industries where you have really the tax base is different from the accounting base, it does not make sense at all if you don't allow deferred taxes.
Sort of lines up with Peter's comment that we would move away from accrual accounting back to just plain cash accounting.
Ian?
Gary?
In my experience, when questions would come in from the investors to the investor relations office, when it dealt with taxes, I mean, I think Martin was right, it's the understanding of the effective rate, or at least maybe changes in the effective rate. And most of the other questions tend to be on cash. You know, if not this year's cash, you know, what does next year portend? And, or of course, they'd like a lot of disclosures on tax strategy. Well, that can't be done quickly, you know, at, you know, particularly for multinationals, just move stuff around the world. But I said at the breakout meetings earlier, I think, disclosing cash taxes paid by the major jurisdictions over time tells you an awful lot of information that gets into your transfer pricing strategy, your cash repatriation strategy, your intra-company capitalization strategy, and so on. Because if you're into tax planning, you know, it's one thing to work the rate down, but the real business deliverable is getting the cash taxes down. And if you're not paying cash taxes in your home country, there's a lot of information that tells your product sourcing is someplace else, or it's telling your transfer pricing is got some risks in it or opportunities, as the case may be. So I think if we're going to go down towards a disclosure type approach, I'd be thinking both the effective rate, but perhaps more the cash content of taxes recent past or in the near future.
I was just wondering, during all this, is this country by country argument being raised by investors? I mean, I know it's raised by a lot of other people, but are the investors interested in that sort of disclosure?
Yes, many investors has asked for a country-by-country report similar to the one that is proposed by the OECD, but they are not asking for all the information because that will be not manageable, but at least they are interested to know where and how much profit is earned and how much tax is paid in the major jurisdictions, because that will help them to identify some of the specific arrangements for tax.
Yeah, and I think their focus is on more disaggregation, so it's not necessarily literally country by country. It's more focusing on the effects on the group as a whole rather than sort of the effects on the individual countries.
But I think some are asking for country by country literally, but that's more from a governance, environment, social reporting type perspective.
Okay. Well, seems like many board members are interested in either type 1 issue or type 3 issue on disclosures. So let's change the plan a little bit because time has running. Maybe Grace can explain about type 1 issue first, and then ask for the comment, and then move on to type 3 on disclosure.
Okay. I would like to go into more details into the type 1 issue, which is arise because of the perceived accounting mismatch. We'll go for two typical examples, which has already been mentioned earlier, which is the intercompany transfer of assets and also the tax base denominated in a non-functional currency. So for the first example, for many multinationals, it's common to transfer assets, especially inventories, among consolidated subsidiaries locating in different jurisdictions with different income tax rates. When the inventory is transferred, the transfer price is usually higher than the cost and generates the intercompany profit. The profit generated is eliminated during the consolidation process, but in accordance with IAS 12, the tax effect has to be recognized. And so, as illustrated in example 2 on page 20 to 21 of agenda paper 19A, when the inventory is transferred from a subsidiary with a lower income tax rate to a subsidiary with a higher income tax rate, a company has to recognize in its consolidated financial statements a current tax liability and current tax expense at the seller's tax rate to represent the tax payable in the seller's jurisdiction, and at the same time a deferred tax asset and deferred tax income at the buyer's tax rate to represent the tax deductible in the buyer's jurisdiction. And as a result, for the year of transfer, there will be a net income tax income. So it is reasonable to recognize the deferred tax asset in the balance sheet because it represents future tax deductible when the inventory is sold in later accounting periods. But some people think that the recognition of deferred tax income also produces a counterintuitive result in the income statement because it is normally expect a first effect in the income statement when the inventory is transferred to a higher income tax jurisdiction, but the result is an overall income tax income. So in 2009, the board issued an exposure draft on the income tax, trying to converge IAS 12 with US GAAP and at the same time to solve some application issues. Some multinationals and their representing bodies in Japan, in Europe, as well as in the US has commented that to measure the deferred tax at the buyer's tax rate distorts the financial performance and creates volatility in the effective tax rate. They request the board to consider creating an exception to the intercompany profit, to create an exception to IAS 12, similar to the US one, which prohibits the recognition of deferred tax for the intercompany profit. The staff also receive similar comments when the income tax project was discussed with GPF at the GPF meeting last year, and also similar comments is received in the recent agenda consultation. So I plan to invite comments after the explanation of another example, but if any board members have questions or comments now.
Errol? Grace, just to ask you, do you want us to comment on whether or not we think that the treatment is correct or incorrect, or are you just looking for us to comment on whether or not we understand the example?
I would like to ask whether you think this treatment is correct or not at the end of the explanation of this type of issues.
Okay, so I actually believe the current accounting is correct. So just putting a marker down for if this comes up at a later point. Yeah, thank you.
As Peter described, one of the biggest shortcomings of IS 12 is we don't know what the deferred tax liability and deferred tax means, because it doesn't necessarily indicate the amount you can save tax or amount you have to pay the tax in the future. So it could mislead a lot of investors. And the typical example is this intercompany transaction. As Stephen mentioned, in the pharmaceutical company, this is a kind of pressing issue. And if you look at the extreme example, the tax rate difference between Ireland and US is about 15% or so. So this could be very significant. And then you can create paper profit only by commodity from Iran in the United States, you can automatically recognize 15% increase of the profit, paper profit, without any risk. So it's I think it's a kind of a significant flaw. And of course, we could address this issue by defining the definition of deferred tax asset liability, like a flow through a method or something. But at least we should do something to cope with this issue.
Mary?
question for Grace, but Grace, you may want to answer it at the end of the section. On page 19, you have a footnote that comments about FASB having put out an exposure draft recently to eliminate their exception, which would have the effect of moving towards the IFRS approach. And it also indicates that they haven't moved forward with it at this time. Is that because their feedback gave them... Do you have any insights as to why they haven't? And I'm not interested in it from a convergence for the sake of convergence perspective. I'm interested in it for what their outreach might tell us about where people think things are useful or not useful, you know, meaningful or not. And in general, that it's a comment about the papers that I thought it was very helpful where there were differences that you talked about, either why FASB has them or, you know, if things are changing. Again, not because I'm interested in convergence for its own sake, but I think it was very informative about you know, how different standard setters have looked at basically the same model. So I thought that was very good information throughout the papers.
I can answer the question now, and I think the response to the U.S. Exposure draft is very mixed. Many comments from the accounting firms and the some other accounting bodies is supportive for the exposure draft, but there are also quite a few preparers comment that this is not this because the original proposal is within the simplification initiative of the U.S. GAAP, and some preparers comment that the proposal actually does not simplify accounting, so it does not meet its objective. And as Steve has mentioned earlier, some pharmaceutical companies has also commented that this does not provide useful information or distort information.
Did they have? Do you know what investors said?
I don't think they have much response from the investors.
You know, Hans, can I build on that? Because I actually went through the prepared responses in the U.S., you know, really actually that their material started with this. And the preparers are pretty clear. It says, look, I mean, we kind of like the answer we got, not surprising, you know, since they had a lot to do with getting it. They said it's not complex. We know how to do it. You know, I think the other point that came through there is there's inventory transfers and there's long-lived asset transfers. Inventory transfers, those are tend to self-correct fairly quickly. I mean, inventory just rolls over. You know, so you might be looking at several weeks, you know, of activity rolling over year end. I think it's a different issue if you're transferring long-lived assets. If
moving licenses and...
Well, I was thinking if you're a, you know, a good example, you know, would be, say, in the oil industry where really heavy-duty equipment is made in one country, and you sell it, you know, to another country, and it's going to take 20 years, you know, for the timing difference to self-correct through depreciation. But I think most of the FASB's activity, I believe, was aimed towards inventory and similar. It does self-correct relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, so you might get the one-time shot, but that's kind of it. I mean, if we were going to do surgical projects on this, this wouldn't be the one I would
well,
pick.
But we have the other answer, and their proposal was to move in our direction.
You know, but that clearly was their proposal, and it didn't, you know, say, as Grace said, it was mixed. It's probably a kind way to articulate the input.
Okay, thanks, Grace. Thanks, Gary.
Okay, move on.
Shall we go to next example?
Okay, I will go forward with the second example, which is related to the tax base denominated in a currency that is not the functional currency of a company. For these companies, the changing exchange rate will not change the carrying amount of non-monetary assets, but the equivalent amount of tax base in functional currency fluctuates along with the changing exchange rate. And therefore, there is a temporary difference, and deferred tax income or expense has to be recognized through profit and loss. The changing exchange rate leads to a real economic loss or gain because a company has to pay more or less tax expense in the future. but the recognition of deferred tax actually captures that economic change. However, some people think that there is no transactions recognized in the financial statement for the change in exchange rate, and therefore the deferred tax recognized is not representing the performance of business operation of the company. And recognizing the deferred tax through profit and loss will create a volatile effective tax rate, even if the actual payments to tax authorities stay constant. And such presentation may distort performance in the income statement. The issue was actually a submission to the interpretation committee last year, but the committee rejected the submission earlier this year because it considered that the standard itself is clear that because the temporary difference arises not from any event or transactions outside the profit and loss, and therefore the tax effect has to be recognized within profit and loss. And another reason is that a company has to recognize, disclose a major component of tax expense or income in their notes. And therefore, if the impact of the changing exchange rate is significant, a company has to disclose in the notes, and such notes will help users of financial statements understand the impact. But although the submission is rejected, the staff include this issue in the agenda paper because we have received one commentator and several online surveys in the agenda consultation comment on this same issue. And the respondents are mainly preparers, and all of them are from South American countries. So I would like to invite comments for this issue as well as for the intercompany transfer of assets issue.
Thank you. I doubt if there is a real economic loss or not. I don't think there is an economic loss. There is an economic loss in terms of functional currency. However, I'm not sure whether it's a real economic loss. So if a company A is a subsidiary of the parent company whose currency, functional currency, is key currency like US dollar or something, then from the viewpoint of parent company, they can say there is some economic loss. However, if this company A is independent company in that country, with using its own country's currency and reporting it to the own country's shareholders and paying tax to their own country with their own country's currency, I don't think there is any economic loss at all. So therefore, it is not solely for the problem of IS 12, but it is also the problem of IS 21, as Amaro pointed out, because we do not differentiate
the case of subsidiary and the case of the parent company. So many South American companies who has operation in their jurisdiction have this problem, and this is significant flaw for those countries. I have strong sympathy to those companies. So I think it's also the pressing issue. I'm not quite sure we can address it in the IS-12 project or IS-21 project.
Sue? I was basically going to say something similar to TAC, but maybe with a different outcome. If I think it's a problem or not, but this seems to me to be really an IS-21 question rather than an IS-12 question, right?
Yeah.
It's just reflecting the effect of translating to a foreign currency in the context of accounting for tax. So it's not, for me, a 12 issue as such.
Darryl? So maybe building on the same set of discussions, I think there are important similarities between the two examples, and I think the similarities are that the reporting as required under 12 and then 12 with 21 provides very useful information for predicting future cash flows, because it tells you about, based on your existing balance sheet and the location of your assets, what the cash flows are likely to be in the first instance based on where the assets happen to be, the inventory and the like, and in the second, what your cash flows are likely to be in the currency you've chosen to present it. I think for me that the big difference between the two examples, though, is that the first one, and this is perhaps explaining my earlier comment a little bit better, in the first instance, I think that the elimination of an intercompany transaction is the elimination because from a group perspective, we do not believe there's been an economic event. It simply moved around within the group. However, I think when you're moving something from one jurisdiction, tax jurisdiction, to another one, that is the economic event. And I think the accounting correctly portrays the economic event, which is the change in economic circumstances. And I think just in thinking about this, the one thing that we may need to take care of is just listening to some of the words that we used in the earlier comment, is there is a concern, I think, in this space about abuse. Now, that doesn't talk to whether or not the accounting is correct as so much as how we would potentially prevent abuse of the accounting happening. But for me, the accounting that we have in place at the moment is the correct accounting. So the first instance, the first example, I think, deals with a real economic circumstance, the economics of the two different jurisdictions. The second one is harder to argue from an economic perspective because it is purely about the currency you choose to report in.
Yeah.
So I think we need to just divorce the two, and I think that's where the 21 comes in.
Yeah.
Nothing economically has changed, but my choice of presentation means that I might need different information because I expect people to use my functional currency as the way they think about my business, my choice of functional, the functional currency I'm obliged to use because it reflects my business. I would like to see the predictive information in that functional currency, and then I think there is a real change.
I agree with TAC and I disagree with Darryl. I really struggle with this economic event argument for the transfer of the inventory. It's not even that you have to physically transfer it. It stays in the same warehouse and just legally been transferred from one subsidiary to another. And in the example one, and when you have that profit of one in the first year, was it? Nothing's happened. The group has not sold the inventory. I know there is the potential now for a different amount of tax as a result of the ultimate economic activity, the sale taking place in one jurisdiction instead of the other. But I think that should flow through the income statement in the period the sale takes place. And I support having deferred tax. I don't think flow through method is the right answer, but I think it should be a process of applying an accruals concept and recognizing a tax effect when we're not recognizing a sale. It just seems to me to be contrary to that accruals concept.
My probably concern with that is I think something has happened, and it's represented in the tax returns of the individual subsidiaries. They will reflect in one case that they sold and the other case that they bought. That is a real economic event. Now, we don't report the individual subsidiary as a standalone, but the reality is we have changed the legal nature of the obligations we have in those two circumstances. And I think that's pretty real.
Yeah, and there is a current tax effect to account for there. Now, the way we do that in IFRS is we account for the current tax effect and we have a deferred tax effect at the buyer's rate. The way US GAAP handles it is by deferring the current tax. But that current tax is, you know, cash tax, to use Gary's term. So there is a real economic effect there.
Yeah. Sue? I'm not sure what the best, most useful information is, which is why I asked Grace if the FASB got feedback from the investor perspective. But I think from an economic perspective, there is a real consequence, because I think what this is highlighting is the fact that we have a consolidation perspective, whereas typically from a tax perspective, it's a legal entity by legal entity basis. And we've got a clash between those two things. And the accounting that we've got, I think, reflects that sort of tax distinction, which is different from the consolidation distinction, whether we like it or not.
But even on a consolidated basis, the tax situation of the group is different by that transfer.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you. So I think to say there has been no sale because we haven't derecognised it from an accounting perspective doesn't take away the fact that from a legal and tax perspective there has been a transaction that matters from a payable perspective.
I just wanted to comment on the functional currency example, because I think it's a good example of a case where people find the information confusing, partly because they don't understand exactly what it is. And in the comment letters we've had on this on the agenda consultation and in the interpretation committee discussions, they seem to focus entirely on the deferred tax line. And of course, the deferred tax line builds up and then reverses. And so they think of it as just a kind of book entry. But if you think of it together with the current tax line, these exchange rate effects will affect the current tax ultimately, and will affect the functional currency equivalent of the tax that's being paid. And all the deferred tax is doing is accruing for it now. And then ultimately the effect does flow through in the current tax.
Okay.
And so I think this is an example of an area where maybe we could do some education to try and explain a bit better that people need to look at the deferred tax and current tax together with each other and not in isolation from each other, and to try and understand, explain a bit better what the information will be telling them.
Okay, Grace, to continue.
Hey, thank you. As we have the pressure on timing, I would like to just skip type 2 issue and move on to type 3 first, and I will explain type 2 only when we have some spare time. So where could you go explain type 3 issue first?
Okay, type 3 issue is about the tax disclosures, which we have a quite long discussion earlier today. The staff have discussed the income tax project with CMAC members in 2015, and following that, conduct an investor survey and also individual calls with investors to understand more about how investors use and what further information investors need to related to income taxes. What we have heard is that they are not very interested or are not really looking for major change in accounting for income taxes. But what they are looking for is more transparent disclosure, and more specifically, the areas for the tax strategy, tax risk, and also tax cash flows. For the tax strategy part, they are looking for more narrations about the main drivers for different effective tax rates from the statutory rate, and for the tax disclosure, cash flows, they are looking for more information about tax laws, because currently the tax laws is usually disclosed in a huge range of duration. It's also usually disclosed that the tax loss is going to be recovered in 10 to 50 years' time, which does not really provide useful information. And because the deferred tax is not discount, the tax loss presented in the income statement is presented in the financial statement is not really useful. And in terms of tax rates, they would like to have more information about the uncertain tax position for making decisions. So as mentioned earlier, in the U.S., the FASB has recently working on two projects that is related to tax disclosure. One is about the disclosure review on income taxes, and the second one is about an exposure draft on the disclosure of government assistance, including tax incentive. And some of the examples of the proposals are the separation of domestic and foreign income tax, improvements in the tax rate reconciliation, and also to introduce the disclosure on government assistance.
Okay, we would like to invite comment from board members. Thank you.
Any comments? You know, just one comment on, I believe, the presentation of separate domestic versus foreign income. That might be in the FAS, but that's been regulation SX for decades. I mean, in that sense, it might be moving from the SEC regs to the FASB literature, but in and of itself, is nothing particularly new.
No further comments?
No.
Okay, thank you. Luckily, I have a spare time to explain type 2 issue. I would like to first of all focus on the issue of corporate wrapper, that is, the interpretation committee discussed in 2004, rejected, but recommended the board to analyze and assess in the research project on income tax because there are some concerns on current requirements in ISWEB. So let me explain what the issue is. Yes. A corporate wrapper is a company whose only asset is a property. In some jurisdictions, it is common to trade property through trading share in the corporate wrapper rather than trading the property directly because there is a tax benefit of trading shares or other benefit of doing so. Because property traded mainly through trading share in corporate wrapper, the fair value of property is computed on the basis of shares in corporate wrapper. And when an entity acquires shares in corporate wrapper, entity accounted for an acquisition of property itself rather than acquiring the business of corporate wrapper. So in accordance with IFRS 3, entity accounted for asset acquisition rather than business combination. For tax purpose, when entity acquire a property through acquiring share in corporate wrapper, the entity acquires two tax bases. One tax base is a tax base of underlying property, and the other tax base is a tax base of shares in corporate wrapper. The tax base of shares in corporate wrapper is same as carrying amount at fair value, but tax base of underlying property is the historical cost that corporate wrapper paid in the past and adjusted by the accumulated depreciation until today. So there's an initial temporal difference between the tax base of underlying property, which is based on historical cost, and the carrying amount of property, which is fair value. In this case, let's call it case one, deferred tax liability is not recognized for the initial temporal difference because IAS 12 has exception for initial recognition of asset or liability in paragraph 15. However, if entity revaluate the property in year 2, IAS 12 required to recognize deferred tax liability only for the revaluation gain. However, in case 2, if the other entity acquire initially the same property at same fair value with the same tax base in year 2, it will not recognize any deferred tax liability at all because there's an initial exception in paragraph 15. The case 3, if the initial acquisition in year 2 was a business combination, IS2 require differently. Entity would have to recognize deferred tax liability for entire temporal difference with the opposite entry to goodwill. So the issue is some people say this is the same property, same fair value, is the same tax base, but amount of deferred tax liability differs depending on whether transaction is a subsequent remeasurement or initial asset acquisition or initial acquisition in a business combination. people think it's inconsistent and not comparable result. I think staff think that issue arises because current requirement ISFAV does not fit well with fair value accounting. Staff look back to the previous document, the background document that ISC published in 1995. It said that ISC created initial recognition exception in paragraph 15 because ISC thought that consideration paid for a long-term asset implicitly took account of the non-deductibility of that long-term asset for tax purpose. If that is correct, the fair value of long-term asset should also implicitly take account of non-deductibility for tax purpose, but current ISFAV doesn't provide similar exception for subsequent fair value measurement, and also treat differently for the asset acquisition in business computation. So one way that board could address this issue is to introduce the exception similar to initial exception in the case of a subsequent fair value measurement, when the fair value already reflects the non-deductibility of long-term asset. I would like to invite board comment on corporate wrap-up. Thank you.
Just let me confirm. When we developed IS 40, is there any discussion about consequential amendment of IS 12?
Peter, would you be able to answer this question?
You're talking about investment property, aren't
you? Yeah, yes.
At the time it was originally developed, there wasn't any discussion of consequential amendments, and partly we weren't really doing many consequential amendments at the time, so I think it wasn't really much of a discussion. There was an amendment we did in 2010 on the investment properties, but that wasn't really a comprehensive look at the issue. I think that was looking at a particular fact pattern and used a slightly different argument to get to an answer that addressed some of these issues in some circumstances, I think.
Mm-hmm. Chung Wu?
Yeah, thank you for very detailed analysis of this issue. My question is, as we discussed before, is it the U.S. GAAP solving some kind of inconsistent kind of result? For example, the gross law method rather than initial recognition exception?
U.S. GAAP has a different requirement and different accounting result. U.S. GAAP require to gross up the property to recognize deferred tax liability and increase the carrying amount of a property. For example, if the fair value of property is 100 and there's a temporal difference, U.S. GAAP required to recognize property for 150 and deferred tax liability of 50 to come up with a fair value of 100. So in comparison with IFRS and U.S. GAAP, there's also a problem in comparability between two standards as well.
Isn't Mitsuhiro, looking at example 5 and corporate wrapper and the example you've got here, but isn't it really a larger issue about inside versus outside basis more generally than it really is the example that's here? I mean, those are not well understood, in general. Maybe the tax professionals understand but do you want to start getting outside of that world, that this is very incomprehensible to most people or black art to others, but inside and outside base is a very common issue, much broader than the example here.
I think, Gary, you are right. We were recently heard from some people from Israel that Israel have similar issues, but not issue of corporate wrapper, different fact pattern, but similar problem in inside base difference and outside base difference. So there's a variation of similar issue, and this is a quite widespread issue.
My comment follows nicely on Gary's, because I think he's pointed out that the corporate wrapper is just the most stripped down version that makes you say, well, if it really is only the building surrounded by a company, you're really unlikely to crystallize all of the inside basis differences by selling the building rather than the wrapper. But that issue of inside versus outside can expand pretty rapidly, and it doesn't get as simple as the building and the corporation are the same, and so that's really challenging. Should you recognize tax based on how you intend to realize the asset, and do you think you have tax planning strategy that could avoid crystallizing, which is really getting into enormous complexity from my perspective. And I think that's one issue that's buried in here. And the other one that's buried in this example is something that you started out with, which is the staff seems to be suggesting that IAS 12 does not cope well when the accounting is based on fair value and the tax regime is based on cost. And that's a more pervasive issue, and it really isn't a corporate wrapper inside-outside basis issue. If that's what the staff has concluded from the research, I think I would suggest pulling that out as a separate conclusion, because I think we do have to think about that, even if only to remind ourselves when we look at an accounting standard that has fair value measurement, have we thought through the tax consequences? And then it becomes a question of, do we think that we have to look again at IAS 12 to see how well it fits generally with fair value, at least so long as tax regimes remain cost basis. It doesn't make me want to immediately jump in and do a big IAS 12 issue, but I think we should separate out the corporate wrapper inside-outside basis, because that's just a particularly annoying or stark version of one category of issues. But I think the more important point that you're illustrating here is the fair value point, and I'd really like to understand, and I think we should report, whether we think it's an inside-outside basis issue, which I do not think it is, or if it's really staff concerns about fair value.
Yes, thank you for asking. This corporate wrapper issue is quite complex. Problem occurs in various reasons. As far as we heard from stakeholders, our stakeholders say three different reasons. One different reason is ambiguity in expected amount of recovery in IAS 12. The other reason is the fair value and cost base difference. And third reason is that, as Gary mentioned, inside the basis, outside the basis difference. And how board could address this issue differs depending on which aspect of corporate wrapper issue board want to deal with. Maybe staff paper is not good enough to explain those different things. We just realized it after posting paper, but I'm sorry, there's a room for improvement. But yeah.
Oh, no, I think it's a very good paper, and you're fleshing out the right issues. But to me, this corporate wrapper with a building, it's a particular issue that I think is very important for real estate, and especially for companies that either own lots of real estate or found a tax-efficient way to transfer it and therefore increase value. But I think in some ways we could get distracted by the corporate wrapper issue, and we should be very aware of what the implications are if we decided to try and address it. You know, and do you go down the fair value route? Do you go down the intended manner of settlement route? It could have lots of unintended consequences for other areas. It's just that it's very stark when you put one property in a single corporate wrapper and you have a tax regime differential like that, and you have the type of asset that often is measured at fair value because that's the most relevant information. And so if we it isn't maybe as narrow and, you know, as targeted or as surgical an issue because of the consequences of our reasoning, if we were to address that for many other areas and how we think about IAS 12.
We go
right. I think
back to the question raised by Taka. Based my memory, as Peter mentioned, unless the issues is tax specific or currency specific, we normally will not have consequential amendment
Oh, really?
To income tax
and foreign currency translation standards. And sometimes in relation to the interim report and the segmental report, it is controversial. Sometimes the board members say, no, it's totally separate. But sometimes we specifically have a consequential amendment to interim and segmental reporting. For example, when we developed revenue standards, and we particularly have a related consequential amendment. Peter, Michael, whether my observation is right? Unless it is tax or currency specific. Otherwise, we normally would not have a consequential amendment to income tax and the currency on currency translation.
Presumably, if we thought there was a particular thing,
yes.
Something unique, I guess, we would look at whether we needed to make a consequential amendment to 12. I think it's different to segment reporting in IAS 34, where I think we generally have a policy of not touching that. I think Peter was referring to the fact that the old board didn't necessarily look at consequential amendments as a routine matter.
Yeah.
But I think now, if we thought there was a particular consequence, we would do something. But I think our starting assumption usually is that IAS 12 has a framework that deals with most situations that are likely to come up, so we tend not to need to make specific changes.
But we did, for example, for share-based payment, where there were some specific issues that came up.
Okay, does this lead to the conclusion of this discussion?
Yes, I think
have
so.
Some issues to discuss.
Well, we have a taxable dividend issue, but we could skip it because it's it is a big issue in some jurisdiction, but I think we have already discussed enough today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and special thanks to Grace. It's her the last time she will be with us, at least in the current capacity. You're going back to your employer, PwC. We were very happy that we could borrow you for such a long time. And we wish you a lot of success back with PwC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we take a break till 11.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.